Chapter 3 Romantic Comedy 2004
Sweetie, you up?
Lizette's Louisiana drawl was both syrupy and whisper light. No one's mom sounded like that.
You awake? Genevieve? My Evie, sweetie? My Eva Diva? You up?
Well, Genevieve, a.k.a. Eva Diva, was up now. The covers were pulled up to her eyebrows, and she was in the fetal position on the ancient, springy twin mattress. Exactly 4 days ago, when Genevieve Mercier and her mom drove from Cincinnati to Washington, D.C., they dragged the mattress up the 5-story walk-up and flung it on the patchy carpet of the bedroom floor. And there it had stayed. Genevieve and Lisette were both the same brand of scrawny and couldn't afford movers. So after struggling to carry Genevieve's mattress and her mom's mattress, plus a small kitchen table and 2 folding chairs, up all those stairs, in the blazing June heat, no less, the nomadic mother-daughter duo had decided they needed no more decor. Genevieve opened one eye and scanned the itty-bitty space. She was 17, and this was a new bedroom. But it could have been any of the ones she'd occupied in any of the cities she'd lived in at 15, 12, or 11. It was nondescript with disposable details except for one thing that was unmistakably hers. A plaid suitcase erupting with clothes, pill bottles, and books. She squinted at the dollar store alarm clock on the bare windowsill. It was 6:05 a.m. Right on time. Lisette always came home just as Genevieve was waking up for school. Her mom was a purely nocturnal animal. It was like their personalities were too outsized to exist at the same time, so the mother claimed night and the daughter got day. Daytime was for responsible people, and Lisette was a delicate, distracted woman, too wispy to negotiate the details of grown-up living, like cooking, paying taxes, cleaning. One time, Genevieve watched her mom vacuum for an hour before realizing it wasn't plugged in. Lisette's beauty kept them afloat, which was hard work. Genevieve knew, so she handled everything else. She forged Lisette's signature at banks. She monitored the pills in Lisette's Valium bottles. She toasted Lisette's hot pockets. She roller set Lisette's hair before she went out on her money dates. You're for sale. Just feckin' say it. They'd moved several times since Genevieve was a toddler. Each time was for a different man who promised Lisette a dazzling life. They always set her up with a place to live, all expenses paid. And it used to be such an adventure. Genevieve had spent first grade living in a designer cottage in Laurel Canyon, rented for them by a famous pop producer who bought her a parrot named Alanis. The year before, an oil big shot had set them up in a St. Moritz chalet, where their cook taught her how to ask for Birke Müsli in impeccable Swiss German. But as Lisette graduated from her hot young thing years, the dazzle dulled. Slowly and then suddenly, the cities got seedier, the apartments got shabbier, and the men got meaner. This latest guy wasn't paying for the apartment, but he did give Lisette a job as a hostess in his cocktail lounge, the Fox Trap. And he was paying her double time. For what, Genevieve didn't want to know. Lisette crawled under the covers, still wearing her BB Freakum dress, and snuggled up to her daughter. She gave Genevieve a lipsticked peck on the cheek and clasped her hand. With a resigned sigh, Genevieve sank into her mom's lushly perfumed embrace. Lisette always wore White Diamonds by Elizabeth Taylor, and Genevieve found the scent overwhelmingly glamorous, but also soothing. That was her mom in a nutshell. White Diamonds. And black drama.
Assess your pain level, spawn of my loins.
Lisette ordered in her outrageous southwestern Louisiana accent. Genevieve raised her head up from the pillow, giving it a little shake. She did this every morning to see how bad it was, and determine how many painkillers she'd need to take to start the day. Luckily, she wasn't in agony. It was just a slow, steady pounding on a door. She could still breathe between the thuds.
"I'll live," she reported. "Good, then give me a story." "I'm sleeping." "You ain't? Come on, you know I can't sleep without a story."
"Can't we go back to when you used to do the stories?"
"I would, but you abolished my storytelling 5 years ago, you little shit."
She cooed, her breath bourbon scented. Years before, Lizette would come home in the mornings and regale Genevieve with tales before she got up for elementary school. Their favorite ones involved long-ago scandals from Lizette's Louisiana hometown, Bellefleur. And though Genevieve had never been there, she knew the place by heart. Bellefleur was a tiny bayou where there were only about 8 last names. Black was the race. Creole was the culture. And everyone could trace their bloodline to the same 18th century pair, a French plantation owner and an enslaved African woman. Along the way, their descendants mixed with Haitian Revolution rebels, indigenous peoples, and Spaniards to produce a rich, insular, filet-flavored culture, both highly religious and deeply superstitious, and colorful in the extreme. The most colorful, though, were Lizette's mother and grandmother. Their reputations were as wild and dramatic as their names, Clotilda and Delphine. Their lives had been affected by murder and madness and mysterious rage, explosive secrets, and a conspicuous absence of fathers. It was as if Genevieve's entire matriarchal lineage had spontaneously regenerated from alien pods. As a little girl, Genevieve assumed that these were tall tales, half-truths. But her grandma and great-grandma sounded fabulous just the same. Lizette wasn't sentimental. The only moment that mattered to her was the one she was in. But she did keep a thin, fraying scrapbook which Genevieve had discovered in a cardboard moving box as a kid. On the last page, there were 2 4x6 black and white photos with Delphine and Clotilda scrawled under them in Lizette's Catholic school cursive. Genevieve stared and stared into their faces until her eyes unfocused, the photos blending into each other. It was like time hiccuped, and she knew Lizette's stories were real. Delphine and Clotilda looked haunted, intense, wild. They looked like women who were born with the wrong mind at the wrong time. They looked like her mom. They looked like her. And suddenly the women didn't seem fabulous. They seemed dark, dangerous, and self-destructive. And it was too familiar. There were corners of Genevieve's brain that terrified her. She was friendless and restless, and pain ruled everything. On her best days, she felt as if she were clinging to sanity by her fingernails. If her great-grandma, grandma, and mom were nuts, and yeah, her mom definitely was, then she was right on their heels. Genevieve wanted to be normal, so she decided to tell the tales instead. Since it was usually too early in the morning to think of anything original, she'd just plug Lizette into movie plots. "There was once," she started, "a down-on-her-luck cutie named Lizette. She wore thigh-high boots and a platinum bob wig and worked, on Hollywood Boulevard. In human resources. One night, she meets a dashing, wealthy businessman. He doesn't care that she can't eat lobster correctly."
"Pretty woman," sighed Lizette. "Richard Gere's black, I feel it."
"You think everybody's black until proven otherwise."
"I won't know peace till I see his genealogy report."
Lizette felt that since Bellefleur was full of black folks who looked white, numbers suggested that many whites could be black. It was all a fine line in the South, she'd say. Given that those sinning, raping plantation owners had both white babies and black babies, Everyone was 6 degrees from being one or the other, which was what scared Southern white people the most. Lizette let go of Genevieve's hand and launched into a cat-like stretch.
I'm gonna have a time falling asleep. Honey, can you brew me up some Liptons?
Genevieve nodded robotically. It was 6:17 and she should have been asleep, but this was her job. She was in charge of daytime. So she disentangled herself from Lizette and shuffled down the short hallway to the kitchen. The hallway was dark, but the kitchen light was on. This was odd. Lizette was maniacal about keeping lights out unless absolutely necessary, to keep the light bill reasonable and also for mood lighting. She froze, a creeping feeling rising in her chest. No, not today of all days. She'd begged her mom not to invite her boyfriends over, and Lizette always assured her that she'd stop, that their home would be a no-man's zone. But by the end of a long, liquor-soaked night, Lizette never remembered her promises, or why she'd made them in the first place. She smelled him before she saw him, Hennessy and Newports. And there he was, a small, round man who looked about 60, slumped over their tiny Salvation Army kitchen table, snoring jaggedly. He was wearing a cheap suit, shiny at the elbows and knees, and a lush, curly black toupee that was as crooked as it was shameless. Genevieve took a hesitant step into the kitchen, the linoleum floor crackling a bit. Bending down to his level, she snapped her fingers in front of his face. Nothing. Good, she thought. Passed out, he was harmless. Holding her breath, she tiptoed past him to the cabinet over the sink. As she reached in for the Lipton, she knocked over a box of Bisquick. It hit the counter with a dull thud, emitting a cloud of pancake powder.
Genevieve, he slurred.
His voice was higher pitched than it should have been, and 2 packs a day raspy.
What's up, Genevieve? It's your name, right?
Yeah, she said, turning around to face him. We met yesterday. He smiled at her with discolored teeth.
I remember.
I bet you do, she muttered. She leaned back against the counter, defensively folding her arms across her chest. Chuckling, he shimmied out of his suit jacket and then thrust it in Genevieve's direction.
Hang this up somewhere, baby.
She eyed the jacket with extreme disgust. We don't have hangers. With a barking laugh, he shrugged and tossed the jacket on the floor. And then he leaned back in his chair and adjusted each pant leg with painstakingly slow precision. He leered at her while he did it, checking her out from the top of her poofy high ponytail to her socks. Genevieve was wearing an oversized men's Hanes tee and sweats. He definitely wasn't catching any of her actual body. It didn't matter, though. His type just wanted to intimidate, assert dominance. She wanted to call out for her mom, who she knew was already asleep. But Lizette wouldn't have helped anyway. The last time she'd told her mom about a run-in with one of her boyfriends, a shadow of something had passed behind Lizette's eyes. And then she dismissed it.
Oh, girl, he's past the point of God's forgiveness, she'd said, all breezy with her movie star smile. You'd like to be clothed and fed?
Genevieve had nodded, teary-eyed but almost numb.
Well, then be nice. Be good, she warned, still smiling. Besides, you're too clever to be prey.
Unlike me, was Lizette's implication. When it came to men, her mom was indeed not clever. Every time one of her terribly dysfunctional relationships imploded, she was confused and stunned. And then, with fresh hope, she'd fling herself at another jackass. Hope was Lizette's greatest downfall. She was like a kid at one of those toy claw machines at Chuck E. Cheese. The claw never actually picks up a toy, no matter how strategically you aim. The game is obviously rigged. But you try every time, because the hope of it finally working just this once is such a thrill. You're pretty, the guy said, the whites of his eyes gone splotchy red. Just like your mom. Lucky you. Yeah, she said dryly. It's worked out so well for me. Genevieve eyed this fool, his insane hairpiece, his wedding ring, and not for the first time wished she were a boy. If she were a boy, she'd knock him into the next life for the tone alone, and again for being married, and then again for letting her mom drink on the job because he knew that was the only way she'd agree to offer off-menu high-priced services to VIP customers. Be nice. Be good. But are you? He asked. Am I what? He stroked the shiny fabric on his meaty thigh. Are you just like your mom? In what way exactly? Genevieve was buying time, trying to figure out how she'd defend herself if it came to it. You mean like in terms of hobbies and interests? Astrological signs? Favorite yin-yang twin? He bark laughed again and shook his finger at her. You're a smart ass. He hoisted himself out of the fold-out chair, ambled toward Genevieve and stopped about a foot from where she was standing. Despite her thrumming sense of unease, she tried to look tough. How old are you? He asked. 17. You look younger, he said, moving a bit closer to her. Jesus, he's one of those, thought Genevieve, her mind racing. He had 100 pounds on her, but he was also drunk and sluggish, and she was fast. Desperately, her eyes darted around the tiny kitchen. There was nothing hard she could hit him with, like a pan or a tea kettle. There was nothing but honey bunches of oats, plastic forks, and Capri Suns. My pocket knife's all the way in the bedroom. She wanted to hurt him before he hurt her. But then there was that old hesitation. Her mom needed this guy. He'd found them this shitty apartment. He'd given her mom a job. He was supporting them. She and her mom were a team. Be nice. Be good. How old are you? She asked, stalling even more. 58. He leaned a bit closer, unsteady on his feet. His after-hours club stench was pungent. But I got stamina. Grinning, he slapped his clammy palm down on her forearm. And then the Lizette-wired part of her brain clicked off. She went completely still. Eyes narrowed. Senses sharpened. Want to hear a joke? She asked abruptly with a sweet smile. A joke? He was caught off guard. Oh, okay, I like jokes. What did Satan say when he lost his hair? I don't know what. She chuckled a bit to herself. How bad do you want to know? Stop playing. Tell me. She glanced up at the rug atop his head. There'll be hell to pay. His mouth dropped open grotesquely. What? You little cunt. He lunged at her. Genevieve dodged to her left, eluding his grasp. Knocked off balance, he toppled drunkenly and then crashed to the floor, a cumbersome, slow-moving vat of lard. Momentarily paralyzed with shock, she just stood there, breathing heavily. And then he grabbed her ankle and yanked her to the ground. She fell down hard. Her head exploded into a thousand shards of razor-sharp glass. Fuck you, she wailed, clutching her face. And then purely out of pain reflex, she reared back and power-kicked him in the ribs. While he roared, she scrambled out of the kitchen on her hands and knees and then sprinted into the bathroom. She slammed the door, locking it with badly shaking hands. Grasping her face with one hand, her head thundering, she grabbed a bottle of Percocet from the sink drawer, climbed into the tub, and snatched the shower curtain shut. And only then did she breathe. Through the cheap hollow core bathroom door, Genevieve heard the guy screaming Lizette's name. And then there was the gossamer pitter-pat of Lizette's feet as she ran down the hall to the kitchen, hollering bewildered nonsense. From experience, Genevieve knew to wait this out in the bathroom. She popped two pills into her mouth and chewed them dry. They were prescribed by her Cincinnati doctor, who, like the countless frustrated docs before him, solved her unsolvable problem with opioids. As Lizette and her man starred in their own Chitlin Circuit revival in the kitchen, she curled up on her side, waiting for relief. Lizette had stopped the hysterics. Now she was cooing. Then Genevieve heard footsteps heading toward the master bedroom. Lizette's Tinkerbell toes barely touching the ground, his steps heavy, labored. Genevieve knew this was her mom's way of protecting her, luring him away and locking the door. Of course, it never occurred to Lizette to kick him out, break up with him, call the police, be single for a minute for that matter, get her own job, finance her own life, save the day herself instead of depending on horrible men to do it for her. Are you just like your mom? Genevieve curled up tighter on her side, trying to make herself smaller. She was exhausted. All she wanted was to escape this repetitive, redundant hell. Her eyes shut. She had only a few more minutes to pull herself together. She had to get ready. Today was her first day at her new school. Monday. Chapter 4. Mantra. You gotta let me talk to Ty, Principal Scott. The beleaguered woman leaned forward on her paper-strewn desk.
Mr. Hall, last time you talked to Ty, I found him sitting in a fifth-floor window with his feet dangling down the side of a building.
His writing was flat. He needed a perspective change.
He's 13. You encouraged a child to engage in potentially fatal behavior.
Ty spent last year in a maximum security juvenile detention center. You think that window was the most colorful moment of his life?
He smiled pleasantly, belying the panic he really felt. Shane Hall wasn't where he was supposed to be. According to the itinerary issued by his publisher's publicity department, he was due at the airport 5 minutes ago. But Ty was his favorite student, and healthy, functional people didn't leave town without saying goodbye. At 32, Shane was new to being healthy and functional. When he woke up 26 months and 14 days ago, clean for the first time since he was under 5 feet tall, he realized that he finally knew how to stay sober. But he wasn't sure how to be a responsible adult. The program encouraged therapy, but fuck no. He was a writer. Why would he give his shit away for free? Instead, he ran 5 miles a day, drank his weight in water, added chia seeds and things, avoided red meat and sugar and hookers. Patiently, he waited for the day it'd all make him feel normal. The only thing Shane could ever do well was write, but he'd only ever done it drunk. He'd become a critic's darling while drunk. He'd gotten rich while drunk. He'd churned out 4 hypnotic, ecstatic elegies to shattered youth, according to the New York Times, while drunk. He'd won the National Book Award while drunk. He'd never composed even one sentence sober, and frankly, he was scared to try. So the writing was on hold for now. He began doing what every non-practicing writer does. He taught. Because his name opened doors and attracted donors at high-paying private schools, he became in demand on the Visiting Author Fellowship circuit. Shane taught creative writing to elite little shits in Dallas, Portland, Hartford, Richmond, San Francisco, and now Providence, Rhode Island. He was usually hired for a semester only, just enough time to shake them up, poke holes in their privileged worldviews, before they slid back into complacency. Fine, but these weren't the real reasons he booked teaching tours. Whenever Shane landed in a new city,
He asked his Uber driver where the worst neighborhood was. He'd go and find the most underserved school in the area, the kind of school that made 7-year-olds line up in the cold at 7:15 a.m. for a security check that took almost an hour to pass through, making them late to class, only to then expel them for tardiness. The kind of school that turned a blind eye to school security officers who maced kids for obscene language. The kind of school that allowed traumatized, abused, underfed, uncared for, often homeless children to be carted off to kiddie prisons for made-up infractions. They'd receive their real education at juvie. And by 18, they'd realize that the thing they were most qualified to be was an inmate. Shane would find a school like this in each city and then practically throw himself at the principal, offering after-school tutoring, mentoring, anything. Shane had a restless urge to help these kids. Actually, he wasn't sure who was helping whom more. Shane stood on the other side of Principal Scott's desk, taking in the dank, closet-sized office. And for some reason, his eyes lingered on a yellowing poster plastered to the puke-green painted wall. Forbidden items, electronics, sunglasses, clothing in gang colors. Gang colors was written in red ink, presumably to target any bloods with big ideas, the cluelessness of which embarrassed Shane. Was that Principal Scott's idea? He was sure that 20 years ago she'd taken the gig thinking she could save the youth like Morgan Freeman in Lean on Me. But today, she was extremely over it, and sporting a violet bruise on her cheekbone where a student had hurled a pencil sharpener at her. Shane had seen it happen. "Mr. Hall," she said wearily, "would you have pulled the window stunt with one of your private school students?" "No, 'cause I don't give a fuck about them." He froze, realizing what he'd said. Christ. He had to be better about blurting out whatever he was thinking. "I mean, I care. I'm just not as invested. Those kids are legacy at Ivy schools. They're good. They're using me for recommendation letters and selfies."
"You take selfies with your students?"
Was that unethical? Shane didn't understand social media. He honestly didn't know. In terms of civilized behavior, he had so many blind spots. Shane wasn't far removed from the man he'd been when he passed out on Gail King's shoulder as Jesse Williams announced that he'd won the 2009 NAACP Award for Outstanding Fiction. His fans thought he was mysterious, living off the grid, no signings or readings or appearances because he was a no-fucks-given bad boy. But really, Shane was just a mess. He just didn't want to be a mess with an audience. So as soon as he could afford to be a nomad, fucking up his life privately from hidden corners of the globe, he did exactly that. In Tobago, he shared his beach shack with a roommate who wasn't shocked by his sketchy table manners or infantesque sleep patterns, because his roommate was a turtle. Shane enjoyed sharing his most demented confessions with that bartender in Cartagena, because she spoke 4 languages, and none of them were English. While Shane Hall had tremendous success thanks to his writing, the writing happened to come from a person who was never supposed to be famous, which, in the highly conventional literary world, had only made him more so. Glancing at his watch, he realized he was dangerously close to missing his flight. Assessing his options, Shane furrowed his brow and then scratched at his biceps just under his short-sleeved tee. He tugged at his bottom lip a little, distracted. Nervous tics, all. But Shane felt a faint energy shift in the room. Principal Scott's gaze had gone from weary to watchful. Shane was a fidgety person, a new thing he realized now that he felt everything. But calling attention to his mouth, his arm, his anything wasn't fair. He knew that he pulled a strong reaction from women. He'd first realized this when he wasn't much older than Ty. Back then, Shane hadn't really known why he elicited this response, and he hadn't cared. He'd just been grateful to have a card to pull, something to use when he was desperate, hungry, and alone. You think I look like an angel. Good. Maybe you'll leave me here with the register while you get my favorite soda in the back. You think I'm a thug? Good. Maybe you'll hire me to rob your ex's crib. You think I'm fuckable? Good. Maybe you'll give me a place to stay for a month. Shane neutralized himself. Healthy, functional people didn't take shortcuts. I'll buy your lunch for a month, he blurted out.
Excuse me?
So much for no shortcuts. You got Venmo? I don't carry cash. I have poor impulse control. Half-heartedly chuckling, she said,
Go ahead. He's in detent.
Shane was halfway down the hall before she could finish the word. Shane found Ty slumped over a desk in an empty classroom, trance-like. He was doodling on the cover of his composition notebook. He'd scribbled on it so much that he could no longer see the designs. But if he ran his fingers over it, he could feel the grooves from the ballpoint pen. Shane had been watching him do this for weeks. It must comfort him somehow. Ty was enormous for his age, about 300 pounds, and at 6'4", he was 2 inches taller than Shane. The boy had a morose self-consciousness that quickly turned to rage if he felt embarrassed or threatened. But he trusted Shane. Shane didn't roast him for wearing the same massive sweatpants and hoodie every day. And Shane knew that he lived with his aunt in a Portuguese gang-run trap house, and that his mom and sister were last seen soliciting together in Hartford Park, but never mentioned it. Shane talked to Ty like they were the same. Shane stood across from him, leaning against the teacher's desk, and told Ty he had to leave Providence. Ty didn't look up.
Where you going?
To Brooklyn. The Liddy Awards are there this Sunday, he explained. I'm a presenter, which is weird because I don't go to award shows.
Why?
Ever heard of Gayle King?
Who?
Never mind, mumbled Shane. I don't go because they're meaningless. In 2013, the National Book Critics Circle gave Best Fiction to Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie instead of me. Do I think she's a superior writer? Nah. But it's all subjective. The corner of Ty's mouth curved.
You mad?
Hell yes, I'm mad, said Shane. 'Cause I care. It took fortunes made and lost, one tarot card reader and too much AA for me to be evolved enough to say those words. I care about things. Ty knew he was being led somewhere.
You say that to say what?
Ty, why do all your questions sound like statements?
The fuck that means?
Look, I'm admitting that I care about awards.
What do you care about?
Nothing, I ain't soft, nigga.
Ain't no niggas in here.
Ty was confused.
You Dominican?
What? No. And Dominicans are niggas. Google African diaspora and learn something. Jesus. Shane shook his head.
Time was ticking. Listen, caring about things don't make you soft. It makes you alive.
Ty shrugged. Shane eyed Ty for a moment, his expression serious. Ty looked back, challenging him.
Tyree.
Yeah.
You need to listen to me.
Yeah.
This school is not designed for you to excel. It's raising you up for prison. Your every move is criminalized by design. In most schools, kids don't get expelled for saying fuck, or get tased for tardiness or incarcerated for missing one detention. In most schools, eighth grade boys aren't terrorized this way. They're allowed to be kids, nothing on their minds but pussy and Roblox.
Ty's eyes focused on his notebook. He was painfully aware that Shane was referring to him. He'd been sent to juvie for missing a detention.
You're mad about it? You want to fight? You're not wrong. They'll tell you you're an animal, but you're not. You're a sane person reacting to an insane situation, and I know because I've been you. It took me getting locked up 3 times by 12th grade to learn the lesson that you're gonna learn today.
Shane paused, realizing he was talking so fast his words were running into each other.
I fought too, just like you.
Well, not exactly,
Like Ty, violent and unpredictable had been stamped in Shane's student file since grade school. Unlike Ty, Shane's violence wasn't about rage. He didn't even fight to win. It was about hurting himself, soothing his self-destructive streak to tear his skin, shatter his bones, gag blood. And that was what kept him shuttling from foster homes to group homes to finally nothing, because no one wanted to adopt a hollow-eyed, passed-over preteen black boy with disturbing compulsions and an unsettling beauty that was weird on a kid so tragic. No one's coming to save you. You have to do it. Shane lowered his voice, wanting Ty to work hard to hear this. Do not react to the school security officers. Do not fight. Stay low, work hard, graduate, and get the full entire fuck out of this city, and don't come back until you're in a position to help a kid like you. You understand me? Silence. Ty. Shane stepped forward, smashing his fist down on Ty's desk. The boy jumped. You understand me? Ty nodded, shell-shocked. Shane was like his fun faux uncle. He'd never seen him be so serious. Hesitantly, he said, I get so heated, I can't stay low. Yeah, you can. Shane's shoulders relaxed a bit. Have faith. Church. I mean, if that works for you, but I meant faith in yourself. What do you like? Ty shrugged broadly. I guess planets. Why? I like that there's more out there. I don't know. I like thinking about other worlds. He was at a loss to describe something he'd never even thought about. I used to draw the planets when I was a little nigga, stupid shit. Nice. Shane pulled a trident pack out of his pocket and popped two pieces into his mouth. Then he tossed one to Ty, who caught it with one hand. There's 8 planets, right? I don't remember all their names, do you? Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. Shane folded his arms across his chest. When you want to fight, recite them in your head. It's called a mantra. A mantra's like a magic spell for your brain, telling it to chill. That's dumb, is it? You like Game of Thrones, right? No. You taught yourself Dothraki. I've seen the inside of that notebook. Ty shrugged again, his chin disappearing into his neck. What does Arya do when she's in danger? She recites the names of people she wants to exact revenge upon. It's her mantra, and it keeps her alive. The planets will be your mantra. Ty could barely hide his delight and mortification at being compared to Arya Stark, and his head sank farther into his neck, rolls of skin puddling up beneath his cheeks. You got a mantra? Ty actually delivered this question as a question. Yeah. What is it? Mine, said Shane simply. He did have one. It was a gift from a girl when he was a boy. And back when he really needed it to, it had worked. He checked his watch. It was time to go to New York. You need activities, said Shane. Your science teacher told me you like astronomy. So I set you up with an internship at the Providence Planetarium. Also, every Friday at 3:30, you'll be a science tutor for struggling students. And don't forget, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. Wait, you already knew I liked planets? Shane grinned and gave Ty a hearty pound. And you said you couldn't name them all, but you just did. Of course I know the planets, said Shane, patting his jeans pockets, making sure he had his wallet. I tricked you. Ty's mouth opened. It's your mantra, not mine. You had to say it out loud to give it power. I'm clueless, whispered Ty in awe. Shane chuckled a little. He'd missed Ty so much. He wanted to hug him, but his file said that he didn't like being touched. Shane understood. Neither did he. He was headed for the door when Ty's voice stopped him. Maybe you need help? In New York? Shane turned to face him. Help?
Can I go with you? Ty's voice was a shy mumble. I could be your assistant.
Shane's shoulders slumped a little. If you need me, I'll come back anytime, for any reason. I promise. Ty blinked several times and slumped down in his chair.
You won't even have time to miss me, dog.
I'll text you relentlessly, the boy nodded. I gotta go. Be good. Just be good, said Shane. And then he all but sprinted out the door. He'd run out of words to say, and he was late. And there was a lump in his throat and a tingle behind his eyes. He wasn't going to cry, though. He hadn't since he was 17. Shane slid into the driver's seat of the rented Audi, blasted the AC, and sped down Route 1 toward Green Airport. He loved that kid too much. He didn't know how to mentor without loving. Maybe doing this wasn't healthy. He knew Ty probably wouldn't make it to his planetarium internship. He might not make it, period. Shane couldn't control that, but he would stay in touch. He always did. He had a Ty or a Diamond or a Marisol or a Rashad in every city. He'd keep them all alive by sheer force of will. The new Shane didn't love and then vanish. That was what he'd done to her, which was the real reason he was going to New York. Shane didn't want or deserve anything from her, and he hated the idea of disrupting her life or dredging up the past, but he had to explain what he couldn't before. Then he'd go. To his credit, he knew this was a terrible idea. To his discredit, he was doing it anyway. He had to. Shane couldn't pretend to embrace his new life when he was still on the run from his old one. She was a fire he'd started ages ago, and for too long he'd just let it smolder. It was time to put it out.
Chapter 5. Fun Black Shit. The State of the Black Author event was a scene. The panel was being held at the Brooklyn Museum's spacious Cantor Auditorium, and it was staged perfectly. To find the space, you had to wind your way through a warren of rooms showcasing the hottest exhibit in town, Nobody Promised You Tomorrow, Art 50 Years After Stonewall. Every clued-in hipster was pretending to have seen it. By the time the crowd had taken in all the gorgeously curated protest art, everyone had entered the auditorium hyped for a fiery conversation. The space was stark, industrial modern, with 200 or so seats and a massive window looking out onto the Caribbean-flavored Eastern Parkway. The crowd was ablaze with color. It was the first hot week of the year, and the sundresses, statement lipstick, and natural dews were in full bloom. Milling about were a mixed bag of high and low literati, old guard writers whose heyday was circa the 70s and 80s, millennial essayists, novelists, and cultured journalists, a handful of deeply feared bespectacled book bloggers, and co-eds from Columbia and NYU whose slogan tees and fashion Birkenstocks screamed feminist studies major. Weaving throughout were digital reporters and their photographers, scanning Hello My Name Is tags to see who was interview worthy. Eva was nursing a seltzer with a sprig of basil. She was also concentrating on looking like a person who wasn't staving off a panic attack. Though she'd killed some time chit-chatting with the few publishing vets she knew, she quickly realized that to the majority of the crowd, Eva Mercy was unknown, or at best recognized as a name in a genre that inspires a very silly fan base. And in a few minutes, she'd have to talk knowledgeably about serious things in front of them.
Chill, woman, she told herself, twirling her vintage cameo ring around her finger. It was her lucky talisman,
and she was counting on it to pull her through tonight. The ring always calmed her. It was stained, nicked, and possibly a century old. Eva had no idea what Victorian-era woman it had originally belonged to, but decades before she discovered it in her mom's jewelry box. No doubt it had been gifted to her by some guy. But Lizette hated vintage jewelry. She demanded brand new diamonds, honey, so she never wore it. Eva cherished old things, though. One day when she was lonely and pimply and 13, Eva stole it from her bedroom. Lizette never noticed. Her mom never noticed anything.
Sis.
Hearing the familiar voice, Eva spun around with a relieved smile. It was Belinda Love, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poetess who was one of Eva's co-panelists. In Belinda's poetry collections, she hopped into the brains of Black historical figures and wrote lyrical poetry about modern life from their specific points of view. Her Langston Hughes piece, "Everything Ain't a Hashtag," was iconic. She'd fallen in instant love with Belinda years ago, when they were seated together at one of CC's exclusive parties. Raised by humble hairdresser parents in Silver Spring, Maryland, Belinda had attended Sidwell Friends School on scholarship during the Chelsea Clinton years and had been a dialect consultant for 10 years' worth of films featuring enslaved or Jim Crow-era Black people. Suffice it to say, she was rarely out of work. As prestigious as her resume was, her vibe was a charming, accessible blend of Earth Mama and Around the Way Girl. She enjoyed Reiki healing and shamanic readings, but also raunchy memes and seducing young men who worked in the service industry. She'd just broken up with a Chilean stunner she'd met while he was passing out flyers in front of a Metro PCS store. "Hey, Belinda," Eva hugged her gently so as not to disturb her cluster of street fair necklaces. Belinda's signature box braids spilled out of her tribal print head wrap, falling to her peach-shaped ass. She looked like a sexy doula. "Come on, dress! Come on, body!" "Honestly, I can't move," Eva whispered. She was wearing a black sleeveless Gucci sheath dress with major plunge and scarlet stiletto booties. Her boobs were hiked up to her chin and her hair was blown out, poker straight. "You did not come to play this Monday evening," Belinda executed a body roll between each word. Eva fidgeted with her hem. "I feel like the office vixen on a network drama about sultry lawyers." "Worked for Meghan Markle. Come on, let's mingle." Belinda linked arms with Eva, and they strolled through the crowd chatting. "Girl," started Eva, "I have someone I want to set you up with. He is cute. Check his IG, @OralBro. Belinda's mouth dropped open. "What kind of blessing?" "Relax, he's an orthodontist. He did beautiful work on Audrey." "Pass. I'm already checking for the hot produce guy at my Trader Joe's. I was there earlier shopping for my vegan bakery course. It's taught by the woman who pioneered vaginal yeast brioche."
"Vaginal yeast brioche?" repeated Eva.
"She's famous for it."
"There's more than zero people famous for making vaginal yeast brioche."
"Anyway, stop trying to set me up. You just want to mine my sex life for book inspo. Why don't you date @OralPro? Get out there, stop wasting your good legs and youthful complexion." "Know why I have nice skin?" Eva winked. "No man stressing me out." Just then, Cece appeared out of nowhere, popping her head between them. "Ask her about a loan," she announced. Then she grabbed Eva's watered-down seltzer, replaced it with a fresh one, and disappeared back into the crowd. Belinda gasped. How does she just materialize like that? And what's she talking about? Before Eva could answer, a young girl rocking a dyed blonde fro and a tube top launched herself into Belinda's arms. "Your poetry is the only thing getting me through my NYU finals. Sign my book?" She thrust a tattered copy at Belinda. "Of course." She signed the title page and gestured at Eva with her elbow. "This is Eva Mercy. You must have heard of Cursed. My stepmom reads that series," she said before quickly snapping a selfie with Belinda. "But I avoid texts depicting explicit cis-heteropatriarchal sex. Sorry." The girl threw up a black power fist and bounced. In seconds, Cece materialized again, glaring at her. "Who let that bleached peasant in here?
Cece was the queen of policing women who had her hairdo, which was half of Brooklyn.
Is she wearing Walmart denim?
Have you ever been in a Walmart? Asked Eva.
Physically, yes. Spiritually, no.
She spun on her heel.
To the stage, it's showtime.
Belinda grabbed Eva's hand and they trailed Cece through the crowd like ducklings. The stage was intimate. A row of four club chairs for Cece, Eva, Belinda, and Khalil. Khalil didn't appear until after Cece's introduction due to a misunderstanding with his Uber driver. The misunderstanding was that he stole someone else's Uber and the driver kicked him out. He was a 37-year-old cultural studies PhD who favored pastel Ralph Lauren chinos and bow ties. He was famous for writing tomes on systemic racism, and he lived with a 60-something Swedish heiress who financed the Ralph Lauren pants and ties. The summer of Eva's divorce, when Khalil was a Vibe columnist, he unsuccessfully pursued her over the course of several Clinton Hill rooftop cookouts. The word mansplainer hadn't been invented yet, but would have been useful. The packed house was fully engaged in the lively discussion of the panelists, nodding, giggling, and recording IG Lives on their phones. Eva was sitting up pin straight, stiletto feet crossed at a ladylike angle, and she was killing it. Yes, the first couple of times she spoke, a few people eyed her with a "who is this again?" expression, but slowly she won them over, so much so that she was wondering what she'd been worried about. As she, Belinda, and Khalil answered Cece's leading discussion questions, their roles became clear. Belinda was the tell-it-like-it-is sister friend. Khalil was the smug blowhard. And Eva was hopelessly drunk on unexpected success.
And here's what's really good, continued Belinda. The publishing industry has a hard time processing black characters unless we're suffering.
Nods and murmurs from the audience.
We're expected to write about trauma, oppression, or slavery, because those are easily marketable black tropes. Publishers struggle to see us as having the same banal, funny, whimsical experiences that every human has.
Because it'd imply that we are human, interrupted Khalil. American society depends on the need to dehumanize, degrade, and deny the black man.
Belinda ignored him. My first novel was about an architect and a chef who witness a murder on a side street during the '03 blackout and have hot sex while solving the mystery. It was rejected everywhere. I kept hearing cute story, but can we hear more about their struggles as blacks in mostly white professions?
Belinda sighed. Like, damn, there's no room for fun black shit? Why can't I make millions off Girl on the Train or 50 Shades?
50 Shades was okay, sniffed Cece. I do wish Anna would have shaved her legs, but yes. White authors have the freedom to tell a good story for the sake of a good story.
Imagine if one of us tried to get Girl on the Train published, said Eva. For colored girls on the train when suicide isn't enough. The crowd erupted in laughter, and Eva beamed like she'd just arrived at the gates of heaven. Sunshine burst from her ears, and her pupils turned into emoji hearts.
Growing up, I was obsessed with horror and fantasy, she said. But black characters were invisible in those stories. Why couldn't I go to Narnia or Hogwarts? When I wrote about a black witch and vampire, the industry was shocked. Like, can paranormal creatures even be non-white? Despite there being a rich black vampire tradition, I mean, hello, Blade, Blackula, Louisiana Fifele folklore, and don't get me started on black witches like Bonnie in Vampire Diaries or Naomi Harris in Pirates of the Caribbean. She paused, realizing she was geeking out and losing her audience. Anyway, only a handful of us succeed in this genre because it can be a stretch to envision a world, even a fantasy one, where all the power players are brown. Comics are the same way. Anyone here been to Comic-Con? Only one person, way in the back, raised their hand. She squinted through her glasses to spot the person's face and saw a 40-something man wearing twinkly eyeshadow and Gia's purple witch hat. A cursed fan.
Aside from wine moms, queer male Gen Xers were her most vocal readers and were loyally devoted to Kirst's social media fan accounts, which flattered Eva to death. But the witch hat, here, when she was trying to look like a serious author? "I rebuke comic culture," spat Khalil. "Even blank Panther. The real hero is Eric Killmonger, but of course, Hollywood strategically emasculates the divine Asiatic black man to appease Eurocentric audiences."
"Do you get your material from a Hotep word generator?" Belinda asked him off mic.
"Fuck immediately off, Belinda," he hissed, and then continued. "Look, I feel like I'm misusing my gift if I don't speak to black male marginalization. The duality of the simultaneous consumption and destruction of black men."
Belinda let out an exasperated snort. "I just think it's really tired and ashy the way you highlight the plight of black men only. Do black women exist in your world?"
"Khalil, your misogynoir is showing," said Eva, to more audience chuckles. She was slaying.
"My only point is, if black people aren't riding with the intent to dismantle white supremacist hooliganery, then we're wasting our voices."
He straightened his bow tie.
"That said, books like Eva's are important, too. Fluff provides an escape."
"Fluff?" Eva was offended.
"Maybe I should have said easy reading," said Khalil.
Maybe we should move on," intercepted Cece, who suddenly paused. She peered into the audience and then drew a wheezy gasp, clutching her Pilates tightened tummy. Since it was impossible to shock this woman, Eva knew something cataclysmic had happened. Had a masked gunman snuck in? Had Zadie Smith shown up after all? The panelists looked in Cece's line of vision. There was a tall, male-shaped figure leaning in a doorway in the shadowy back corner of the auditorium, with a recognizable face.
"Shane," started Cece.
"Hall," finished Belinda. The audience began peering over their shoulders, eyes darting around the room. A flurry of exclamations floated from the seats.
"What? Where? Stop!"
Eva said nothing. When a horror movie character sees a ghost, she emits a blood-curdling shriek, claws at her cheeks, runs for her life. Eva was trapped on stage in broad view of New York's literary community, so she did none of those things. Instead, her hands went completely slack, and her microphone slipped to the floor with a heavy thunk. No one noticed, because everyone was focused on him.
"Shane," Cece bellowed. "Is that you?"
He peered around the doorway, wearing a sheepish grimace.
"No,"
he said.
"Yes,"
someone yelled.
"Get up here," ordered Cece.
He shook his head with a "please don't make me do this" desperation in his eyes.
"Excuse me? I discovered you cleaning rooms at the Beverly Wilshire Kid. You better get up here. And you owe it to everyone in the room who has contributed to your popularity despite the careless way you've treated us."
Shane looked behind him, as if assessing whether he could make a run for it. Begrudgingly, he headed to the stage. Eva rarely saw things in crisp focus, even with her glasses. Her head always made the world a shade fuzzy. But as Shane walked down the aisle toward the panelists, toward her, every detail in the room became razor sharp. She was agonizingly aware of everything and every part of herself. This couldn't be real. She knew it was, though, because her physical reaction was operatic. Her breath went shallow. Her pulse was thundering. She began to tremble all over, caught in the crossfire of a zillion powerful conflicting emotions. Eva wasn't particularly religious, but she'd always felt there was something out there, watching over her, for many reasons, but mostly because she had never run into Shane Hall. Ever. After all this time, it was definitely astonishing, given that they were both black authors of the same age who'd become successful in the same era. If that wasn't divine intervention, she didn't know what was. But now he was here, flesh and blood. It was the moment she'd always feared, but below that,
in the tucked-away pockets of her subconscious. Wasn't it also the moment she'd always anticipated, planned for, even dreamed of? Maybe, but not like this. Not in public. Not unprepared. The deafening applause sent the gentle throb in her temples to daggers and reminded Eva where she was. The room was in an uproar. Shane was a literary star. He'd written only 4 novels, 8, Seesaw, Eat in the Kitchen, and Lock the Door on Your Way In. But they were canon. The setting was always the same nameless neighborhood crippled by devastating poverty. His characters were whimsical, vivid, practically mythologized humans. And through ecstatic attention to detail, emotion, and nuance, he artfully manipulated readers into becoming so invested in his character's every thought that 50 pages would go by before they realized that there was no plot. None. Just a girl named 8 who lost her keys. But they'd weep from the beauty of it. 8 could have seen a dude shot dead in the street while she was locked out, but readers would have cared only about her. Shane tricked his readers into seeing humanity, not circumstance. You walked away from his books dazed, wondering how he'd managed to rip out your heart before you realized what was happening. Every 5 years or so, he'd drop a book, give a few choppy, unrevealing interviews, sulk through an MSNBC segment, sweep awards season, unless he was up against Juno Diaz, land a massive grant to go off somewhere and write more classic shit, and then disappear again. Of course, he never fully disappeared. There were sightings. He'd visited the opening reception of a Kara Walker exhibit in Amsterdam 3 springs ago. But when it was time to read the foreword he'd written for the show, he'd vanished. So had Kara's curvy publicist, Claudia. In 2008, he'd gone to the White House correspondence dinner but spent the whole time drying dishes with the busboys in the kitchen. He'd definitely attended J. Cole's nuptials in North Carolina because he'd told a guest that the only thing he liked about the South was Bojangles, which was instantly all over Twitter. Years ago, an LA Times editor had started a rumor that Shane was a hoax and someone else was writing his books, because he didn't behave like an A-list author, and frankly, he didn't look like one. He was all jawline, pouty mouth, and unreal eyelashes, a face that had made him special before he had proved it. Shane Hall was intimidatingly handsome. And yet on the rare occasion he smiled, it was so radiant, so warm, like peering into a goddamn sunbeam. The effect was disorienting. You wanted to either pinch his cheeks or beg him for a hard fuck on a soft surface. You just needed whatever he had. Eva knew this better than anyone. At least she used to know. She hadn't seen him since 12th grade.